All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers? What the fuck buddies? What the fucking ears? What the fucksters? What the fuck sticks? How about that one? How about it? Welcome. I'm Mark Maron. This is WTF, my podcast. Thank you for being here. I just drove back from Phoenix, where I did two shows on Saturday night at Stand Up Live, and they were spectacular. Sold both shows out. Andy Steinberg opened, Ryan Singer featured. I did the nice big hour 15, hour 20 close with the new stuff, and it was great. It was great. I drove there. I mentioned that. I just drove back because I'm punchy, because I wanted to drive. Why didn't I fly? Because I wanted to have the meditative experience of driving 5.5 hours to Phoenix, 3 or 4 of those through the desert, where it's just you and the horizon. My buddy Singer's there. We're listening to Beatles music. We're listening to a lot of different kinds of music. We're talking, and we're just having that. You kind of zone in to the drive, and things just get, it just got that, all the stuff that you carry with you kind of dissipates into the horizon line of the desert. It was great. It was great. Let me get, I want to tell you this, so this is exciting and important. I have Alan Alda on the show today. That's exciting and important. And also, you can now get my special, More Later, as a digital download. A lot of you couldn't watch it or didn't watch it or couldn't figure out how to watch it. You can get it now. More Later is available exclusively at WTFpod.com until September 1st for $7.99. So like, get that thing now before the price goes up. You can go to WTFpod.com. And there's a link on the homepage as well as in the merch section. You can just own it. Own More Later. This is how we're doing it now. I'm very proud of that special, and I know a lot of you didn't see it. So here's your shot. More Later is now available. So what's going on? Yeah, I made the big drive to Phoenix, and I had some kind of emotional. It's emotional, man. Some of you know a little bit about me. Some of you know more than others. But Phoenix is a relatively loaded bit of geographical for me. My first wife was from Phoenix. My former in-laws live in Phoenix. My former sister-in-law lives in Phoenix. And it's a troubling thing to me that I'm yet to make that amends. I just can't seem to pull it together. After a certain point, if it may harm myself or others, or why am I doing it, stuff, water under the bridge, she's happy, they're okay, we're all good. But nonetheless, I've gone there a lot. My brother lives there, and his wife and kids, and his ex-wife and their kids. And, you know, it's all loaded up. Phoenix is all loaded up. And I drove out there, and what I didn't expect was, an old friend of mine, my best friend in high school, a guy named Dave, was a guitar player, Dave Bishop. His pop owned a stereo place in Albuquerque. We were best friends in high school, and he passed away many years ago. And he has a little brother who I knew as well, a couple years younger than me, not much younger, named Roger. And I had not seen Roger in 30 fucking years. And Raj came to the show with this other kid who went to high school with me, but was Roger's age, a couple years younger. But I used to drive them to school. I used to see them all the time. And I hadn't seen Raj in 30 years, and he came to the show, and after the show, we hung out, and it was like, it was like almost crying. It was just like, I couldn't believe that you don't see someone that long, and so much has happened in each of our lives, but the essence of the guy is there, and I'm sure my essence is there, and the absence of this guy that was his brother and my best friend, becomes living in between us. And it was really fucking touching. And sometimes I forget, you just get consumed with life and you get consumed with the pace of what you're doing and running and doing whatever it is. And then you just have this moment where you're like, holy shit, so much emotions, so much past, so much, grief that was unresolved. And it's just like in this moment, you see the person. I'm like, God damn it, man. It's great to see you. And he gave me a couple of pictures that he had of me and Dave, Polaroids. I hadn't looked at him, from high school, and his mom was in one, she's passed, and I knew his dad, and he's gone, and wow, man, it was just fucking great. And you forget that that's an amazing part of life, is that, to try to maintain these relationships, or at least get up to speed with people that had a place in your life at some other time. If there's no bad blood there, why not connect? And it was just powerful. I took like an hour or two to really kind of process and feel what came up, just thinking about Dave, thinking about how funny he was, thinking about how great a guitar player he was, and thinking about like all that life I missed and all. It was a beautiful thing. All right, it's a beautiful thing. And I saw my brother and he's doing okay. But I got to remember, man, you know, life, whatever life is made of, part of it is that. Where'd you come from? Who were your people? Are they still around? Do you have unresolved stuff? Is there some way to access those feelings again? It was just great hanging out with Roger and thinking about Dave and talking about Dave. It was it's heavy, man, but it was beautiful. I'll tell you, there are some liabilities, folks. There are some liabilities to technology, and I'll tell you one of them. Ryan and I were driving back, and we're driving back from Phoenix, and we're listening to Apple Music through my phone and through the Bluetooth in the car. We start talking about Pet Sounds and Sgt. Pepper, and I was like, "When was the last time you listened to Sgt. Pepper?" And we decided it had been a while. So we put on Sgt. Pepper, and I'm ecstatic. I just get overwhelmed with excitement, and at some point I go, "There's no way Pet Sounds is better than this. I don't care who did what first. No way." Now, I got nothing against Pet Sounds. Not a huge Beach Boys guy, but I appreciate it, and I understand the genius of it. But Sgt. Pepper, come on. So now we're on a roll, and we're like, let's do Abbey Road. Specifically, let's do Abbey Road Part 2. You know, side two, because that's the medley. That's, you know, you never give your money into One Sweet Dream, pick up the bags, get in. Like, it's just like that whole run of side two of Abbey Road is fucking astounding. Now, I don't need to pitch the Beatles. You know what I'm talking about. So here's what happens, because we're driving through the desert. We're fucking going, man. We're going. We went, you know, we got into You Never Give Me Your Money all the way through that. We're in Sun King. We're singing along. We're in Mean Mr. Mustard. We're fucking in it. You know, we're singing along to Mean Mr. Mustard. Then the end of Mean Mr. Mustard comes out, and we're about ready to launch into Polythene Pam. You know, bam, bam. And right when we're both about to launch in, we lose the signal. It drops out. We're hanging there at the end of Mean Mr. Mustard, unable to enter Polythene Pam, to get closure, to get resolution, to get the endorphins that come with that song. Unable to do it. It was so, so digital blue ball-y, so horrible. It's a, you know, it is not a big problem, but man, we were in it. We were in it, and then we were fucking ripped out by poor coverage in the desert. Left hanging between Mean Mr. Mustard and Polythene Pam. It was brutal. It took us a little while to get back to it. We had to shut down the music entirely and just deal with the fucking sadness of being just halted at such a decisive moment. So Alan Alda, I had this conversation with Alan Alda in a hotel room in New York City, and I was talking to him about talking to Louie about casting him in Horace and Pete and how that happened. And then, of course, you know how I work. I turn the mics on in the middle of something. We kind of enter, me and Alan enter talking here about Horace and Pete and about, you know, Louis' casting and how that worked and whatnot. So this is me and Alan Alda talking about a lot of things. He's a very talkative guy, very thoughtful guy, and one of the great actors and a great character. So this is me and Alan Alda. Every now and then, there's a decision that's a no-brainer, and I can tell you from experience, it was a no-brainer to use Stamps.com when we started using it 11 years ago. Crazy. 11 years ago. Now, more than a decade later, Stamps.com is better than ever. The Stamps.com mobile app is like having a post office in your pocket wherever you are. You can take care of things on the go, like mailing checks, sending invoices, legal documents, and more. Easily schedule package pickups through your Stamps.com dashboard. And when you need to take care of shipping, all you need is a computer and printer. Stamps.com even sends you a free scale. Make the same no-brainer decision that over 1 million other businesses have with Stamps.com. Sign up with the promo code WTF for a special offer that includes a 4-week trial,
plus free postage and a free digital scale. No long-term commitments or contracts. Just go to stamps.com, click on the microphone at the top of the page, and enter code WTF.
Alda.
That's the weird thing about television, is sort of imprints people. You know, you're on there long enough. Like, you know, my mother, everybody watched MASH. Yeah. So,
everybody plus your mother.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, I started to say something that I realized I didn't want to sort of make it seem like
a, like, you know, your mother liked me more than you do.
Exactly. Well, yeah. I was sort of a kid, you know, at that time. Yeah. I'm 52, but
you're young enough to be my kid,
right? Yeah. Almost. Yeah. Almost.
Yeah. No, I have kids older than you.
You do?
Yeah.
How old
are
you?
80.
It's unbelievable. It's unbelievable. No.
Well,
you'd
80. Be 80 for a few days. You'll believe it.
You look great, though. And you'll watch you on Horace and Pete. You know, you're playing 60.
No, I think I don't look as old as I do in Horace and Pete, except sometimes when I walk down the street and they take my picture and put it on social media.
Oh, do they?
Yeah, right.
Then I look
about 89.
Yeah. Those...
So I didn't. So the thing is, you have to play a character using what I would think of as spare parts of yourself.
Mm-hmm.
If you're going to be semi-believable in it has to come from some authentic place,
right,
in you.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, I mean, and we all have a lot of different people in us, and the job of an actor is to find those parts of yourself that match up with the character as well as you can intuit it.
And that's how you break it down. Because they're very interested. You know, I talk to actors sometimes, not a ton, but, you know, to talk about how they, you know, what is the work of an actor?
Yeah, it's hard to say. I mean,
I know, right?
I make up.
I like what you just said, though.
Well, that's the way I imagine I'm working, because I work in a different way every time. I sort of invent a new method every time I do it.
Well, when you got that script, when he sent it to your agent, when you looked at it, what was your first thought?
I thought, this is beautifully written.
Yeah.
And I'd really like to do it.
Yeah.
And the next thought, which I didn't divulge to Louis, was, how the hell am I going to do that?
You had to find the monster inside of you.
But I had, no, it's not that, because he may come out as a monster, but you don't go looking for a monster.
Right.
You find out why he's right.
Right. Oh, interesting.
And why he, not only do you have to know what he wants, you have to know that he deserves to get what he wants.
Interesting. So you have to decide that.
You have to have the same urges and desires and the same avoidance mechanisms and all things like that.
Right.
Nobody who's really a creep thinks that he or she is.
Right.
You know, we do these things because it's the only way to protect ourselves against what's coming at us,
which is ultimately death and whatever we manufacture.
Yeah, that's what I love about Louis' writing, is that he can be funny at the same time that he realizes we're all going to die.
Yeah, well, that's the trick.
Yeah, I mean, that's then you got everything.
Right.
Then the two masks, the two Greek masks come together.
That's right,
That's for me, the best kind of stagecraft, because it's what life is really like. Life is fun and tragic.
Yeah. Yeah, and there's no avoiding it.
You can't. You can avoid the fun if you're really careful.
And what was it like working with him as a director? I mean, because it sounded to me, and talking to him, that, you know, you guys were kind of, you know, meeting at his house and doing read-throughs.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. I said to myself, I have confidence that I can do this, although I don't know at the moment how that's going to happen.
Right.
And I could see on his face that he was getting confidence I could do it too, but he didn't have any idea how I was going to go about it. And I really admired that in him. I was amazed at it. I don't know if I'd be that kind of brave if I were directing. But he's very smart as a director, and the things that he has as a comedian, as a writer, and as a person, he brings to the directing, which is that he's very sensitive to who you are and what you're thinking, what you're going through, and he doesn't intrude on it. And yet he's frank,
right?
Very frank. He says, you know, if you do that like that, it's going to look like shit.
That's good.
That's honest. Way better to hear than somebody going around the corner pretending he doesn't really mind this terrible right. thing you're doing.
Yeah, then he goes around the corner and goes, what are we going to do with Alden?
How can we fire this guy? We'll get in the paper if we fire him.
Crazy. He's going to ruin the whole thing, this guy. Well, that's
He's very, very, really one of the best. It's one of the best, if not the best experience I think I can remember having acting.
No kidding.
Partly because, I mean, there's no doubt that MASH was an extraordinary time in my life.
Right.
It went on for 11 years, and I learned a great deal. So that was wonderful.
Right.
This is wonderful because now I'm at this age,
yeah.
and I'm still learning, and I'm still able to do things I couldn't do before.
Right, because you have hindsight.
I've got experience, yeah. And that makes me feel great.
Yeah.
I feel like a kid again when I can do something I never did before. You know, it's like when you first learn to ride a bike, you feel like a grown-up.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah, and you're surprised you're up, and it's exciting.
Yeah, and the wind's in your face, and you've never had that experience before.
And it's like it felt like a theater piece, didn't it? I mean,
most at home on the stage.
Yeah.
So the idea that you start a scene or a clump of scenes.
Yeah.
And you don't stop until you get to the end of that.
Yeah.
It's opening night.
Right.
You're in charge.
Right.
Nobody's going to cut your performance.
Right.
You have final cut on the stage.
Yeah, and he let that happen.
And he lets it happen. And then at the end he says that was mostly good all the way through.
Yeah.
Let's try to get it better all the way through.
But he lets you have the whole emotional arc of the piece.
Yeah, and you discover it moment by moment.
That's beautiful.
It's not intellectualized.
Did you like working with Steve?
Yeah, very much. I had always wanted to work with him.
Oh, that's
great.
I really
admire him. And Edie Falco is
she's
so delicious as an actor.
In that
last episode,
all in,
she breaks your heart.
Oh my God! Yeah,
I mean you're a little scared for her.
Yeah, you're scared for everybody in that show.
Yeah,
you know, even people that are fundamentally unsympathetic, like your character, but you do find sympathy for him somehow.
You know, somebody said I saw when I opened up my Twitter account once. I saw somebody said that she liked Uncle Pete. I mean, because he was raw and vulnerable.
Right.
And being on the inside of him while I shot it, I didn't know
that
you could apply those words to him, that he was vulnerable. And then I remembered a couple of moments where he really was vulnerable.
Yeah.
But he expressed his vulnerability by lashing out and being as vicious as he could.
Right.
But it was out of vulnerability. And if I had known it was vulnerable at the time, it would have changed how it came out. It would have been soft.
Right, right. Well, I mean, that's what makes it beautiful, is it open to interpretation. You know, you can't overthink it. Let other people put what they're going to have.
Yeah, see, I started in improvising.
Well, that's it. Well, where were you born? Here?
I was born in Manhattan on 33rd Street and 3rd Avenue.
Really?
Yeah.
What kind of business was your dad in?
He was in show business. He was a singer and a straight man in burlesque.
Really?
And I spent my first years standing in the wings, from the age of about 2 and a half, standing in the wings.
At the big variety houses here? Or at the big theaters?
Well, he was in a company that toured the whole Eastern Seaboard. I remember being in Baltimore and Washington and up to Toronto. We'd go by train.
Yeah.
And then we'd go to the hotel and we'd go to the theater and they'd rehearse. And I'd stand in the wings and watch the strippers and the chorus girls and the comics. I learned a lot from watching the comics.
Like, who were the guys then?
Phil Silvers, Hank Henry.
Yeah. Really?
They carried me on stage when I was 3.
Phil Silvers did?
Yeah.
Did they do a bit?
It was a schoolroom sketch. And so they brought me out in a high chair.
Right.
I almost said wheelchair. Now they have to bring me out in the wheelchair. Well, soon. Not now. Mm-hmm. But it was, and their story about that was that I would ring the bell, and I had a bell on my high chair, and I would ring the bell and blot out their punchlines.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
You didn't know you were doing it?
Didn't know. Maybe I did.
Uh-huh. Were you the only kid?
As I know, I was the only kid. One time, my father's partner in the comedy sketches was Hank Henry. And as a joke for Hank, he had a scene where he was drunk and trying to rob a safe.
Yeah.
So the idea was he was too drunk to really get to the safe very
right.
carefully. It was a pantomime sketch. Yeah. So they hid me in the safe
right.
without telling him.
Uh-huh.
So when he finally got the safe open, they said, now you step out and you say, Father. I don't know why they thought that was funny.
Did it get a laugh?
I have no idea.
You don't remember.
But then they said, they never let up on me. Then they said, now go to the manager of the company and tell him you want to get paid 10 cents for being in this sketch. He had no sense of humor whatsoever for a comedy show manager. He said, what?
Yeah.
Get out of here, boy. You bother me.
So he did singing too?
He was a singer. He would stand on the side of the stage and sing in the opening number while the chorus girls paraded half naked.
Half naked.
Nobody paid any attention to my father.
Yeah. And because some of those guys, I think Hank Henry and certainly Phil Silvers, went on to create television in a way.
Well, before that, they were known in movies. They uh-huh. had a lot of character parts in movies.
Oh, both of them?
And my father went on to be a big movie star. I don't know if you know that.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, he played, his first part was playing George Gershwin in the film biography of Gershwin.
And, oh, really?
Called Rhapsody in Blue. And he was known all over the world for that.
No kidding.
Yeah.
What name did he go by?
Robert Alda.
Oh, yeah? Was that the original name?
No, his name and my name are the same.
Yeah.
Alfonso D'Abruzzo.
Oh, really? You're Italian?
Yeah. Well, half Italian. My father's side is Italian.
Did you grow up with that?
Well, I grew up thinking of myself mainly as Italian, although my mother was Irish.
And was she in show business as well?
She had won a beauty contest, but she was not in show business.
Now, you're the only kid?
Yeah, yeah. My father then remarried, and I had a half-brother.
I think I knew him.
A
little
Anthony
bit.
Anthony Alda?
Yeah, sorry about his passing.
Yeah, thank you.
He was a good guy. He ran. I knew some people he knew out in L.A.
Oh, I didn't know that.
They're like Robert Zimmerman and a couple of the friends. There was a crew out there that that kind of hung out that I met early on. Yeah, he's a drummer, right?
Yeah, he could play a lot of instruments.
Yeah,
Very talented. He could write, he could direct, he could act, he could play a couple of instruments.
Yeah, I think I played with him once.
Oh, yeah? What do you play?
I play guitar.
Oh.
And I think I went over to Ron Zimmerman's house and played with him. Tony, he went by.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. He's a good guy.
Yeah.
So now, was you destined to be in show business?
Yeah, I couldn't. I mean, standing in the wings, watching. My father did Guys and Dolls when I was a teenager. He was
here in the city?
Yeah, yeah, on Broadway. Yeah. He created the part of Sky Masterson.
Right, right.
So I'd watch two shows a week, and it was the same experience as when I was a kid watching the comics, you know?
Right.
You learn a great deal watching from the side.
Of how, I love that about show business, that everything that goes on backstage,
yeah,
like the effort that goes in, the people that are involved. Sometimes there's animals going in
exactly.
and out.
Exactly. You can't see any of that.
Right.
You can't see how it's put together
right.
when you're in the audience.
Yeah.
In the audience, you get the illusion created. But when you're standing on the side in the wings, you watch the illusion being created.
Right.
And you learn, because I used to know those people on stage really well.
Yeah.
And I saw how they drew on themselves. I saw how they altered the rhythms as they spoke.
Yeah.
It was a real education.
And also, having the experience of being your father's son off stage and knowing him as a man and then see him inhabit a character that sings and dances.
Right.
That must be a tremendous kind of shift. You understood that there was a skill set involved early
exactly.
on.
Exactly. I mean, it wasn't that I saw my father doing this amazing thing. I saw how he did it.
Right.
I saw how he drew on himself to do it.
Oh yeah,
and I saw his mannerisms sometimes that I didn't admire.
Oh, the bad ones.
And I early on I thought I was superior to my father who had all this experience.
Like what?
I was a snotty kid.
What's a mannerism that you didn't admire?
He used to put his hand on his belt.
Yeah,
where his or on his kidneys or something.
Yeah.
I don't know what part of your body.
You just rest it there?
I'm putting my hand there. What would you call it?
On your hip.
Not quite the hip.
A little above the hip.
Close
over by
to the
stomach.
Belly.
Yeah.
And it's like a way of holding your jacket in.
Yeah,
He'd make an entrance on the stage when he'd going to announce something.
Uh-huh.
He'd start from upstage and he'd have his hand on his belly.
For
and he'd
effect?
Walk. Yeah. It's like, here I come.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And he'd walk down toward the audience.
Uh-huh.
And I thought, that's so self-aggrandizing. What is he doing? But probably he was protecting himself against his own fear of coming out on stage.
Right.
But to me, it was not genuine, and I really didn't like it.
But there was a showmanship to burlesque.
Hey, don't bother me with your opinions here.
But wasn't there a showmanship to that? I mean,
exactly. That's what he was doing. And
it was too broad for you.
Yeah. Right. I got an early, I guess an aversion to the show business end of it. I was really interested, I thought, in something more genuine. It took me about 20 years to get close to genuine.
Well, that's interesting because that wasn't really the mode then, was it?
You're right, especially not from burlesque.
Right. You thought that, like, if you're going to be up there, why don't you have some honesty about it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know why I got that, because here I was exposed to all this other stuff. But
yeah.
What really used to really get me interested and get me engaged was to see them take off on a riff, to suddenly be inspired in that moment and sometimes make up new dialogue.
In the comedy bits?
Yeah.
Yeah.
But then when I was watching Guys and Dolls and I watched this great actor, and my father played opposite Sam Levine, who I thought was a kind of a genius, he would do it completely differently every night, and yet he said the same words and stood in the same spot. But a different kind of music came out of him.
Huh.
And the laughs would come in different places.
Interesting.
Isn't that interesting?
So you knew that
I just thrilled to this extemporaneous riff he could go off on and still be disciplined, still keep it the same words.
So he could mix it up. He could make it fresh.
He went with it wherever it went.
Right.
He didn't deliberately mix it up. He didn't say, now I'm going to do it. Because you can hear that when an actor says, now I'm doing it differently.
Right, right.
It's intellectualized.
Right, right.
Know?
Yeah. And when you saw that stuff, when did you start to, you know, to integrate and perform yourself?
I never wanted to be anything else, except I wanted to be a writer when I was 8.
Yeah.
And always have wanted to write.
What kind of writing? Do you see yourself as a novelist?
I've written 5 movies.
Right. But you wanted to do that early on?
I wanted to. My father had a stack of scripts from burlesque. Yeah.
Right.
So I used to read the scripts and I wanted to write my own sketches.
Did you try?
Yeah. When I was 8, I wrote a courtroom sketch.
Did they do it?
No. But they were all proud of me for trying.
Oh, that's nice.
There were sketches in there. I had no idea what they meant.
Right, right. Of course. Yeah. They weren't supposed to. It wasn't for you, right?
Yeah. I mean, I remember one. I remembered it because I couldn't figure out what it was about.
Yeah.
A man gets out of bed and says, oh, my God, what a night. Another man gets out of the same bed and says, oh, my God, what a night. Another man gets, oh, my God. And finally, a woman gets out and says, oh, my God, what a night.
That was the whole bit.
That was the whole bit. And I wondered what it meant. And I said, the comics are coming over Sunday night to have fun and put on sketches. Can I do that sketch? And he said, no, that's a little raw for you.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
You didn't know what it meant.
I didn't know what it meant.
You knew you wanted to do it.
But it had a nice rhythm, you know?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So when did you start acting?
Well, when I was in school, I was acting. I wrote a musical comedy when I was in high school.
Yeah.
And naturally, I acted in that.
Sure. What was that about?
That was called Love's the Ticket, and it was about two college kids in France who've run out of money, and they decide the way to get home is to get two girls to fall in love with them and take them on the boat.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
Well, that's not, that sounds
See,
nice.
See, that's not Mr. Nice Guy.
No, but it must have been not that loaded.
They had to come clean finally, you know.
Right, and disappoint the girls, who I guess at that point said, it's okay, we had a good time, we'll
No,
take
the,
it anyway.
The girls said, the girls rebelled. They said, what the hey?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know.
So you didn't get the boat? No boat?
I think we wound up on the boat. I loved those musicals that took place on a boat.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
The second half of it was on a boat.
You're stuck there.
Yeah.
No getting off the
you
boat.
You are stuck on a boat. I don't like boats.
The worst.
And the other thing is they're on the water.
Yeah.
The ocean is...
Two negatives.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The ocean is a very powerful, dangerous thing.
Yeah, deep and scary, and I don't know what's under there. Yeah. I have a hard time in pools at night.
Well, don't go into pools at night, for God's sake.
Right. I mean, either you have that fear of water or you don't.
I almost drowned in the ocean once.
Oh, that'll do it. In an undertow situation?
Yeah. Kept pulling me out and slamming me down.
Right. The worst.
Yeah. And then at first I thought, this is fun. Then I thought, I'm going to die.
And that's Louis C.K.'s work.
That's See, there is a theme to this conversation.
Yeah.
He has that. It's just... Yeah, how about Laurie Metcalf?
Oh my God!
Is that one, maybe the most amazing? I've never seen performance like I've ever seen.
Right, that's what I said. I said I've never seen a performance like this anywhere.
Yeah,
it's the best thing I've ever seen in my life.
Just gorgeous.
Have you met her before?
And I never met her then because I wasn't on the set.
I shot my part of it at
another time because I had to go to Australia.
Oh yeah, what'd you do there?
I've started a center for communicating science because, as you may know, I'm really interested in.
Well, no, I saw that, and you're doing this flame challenge.
Yeah, every year we have the flame challenge, which is one of the projects we have.
Yeah, and what is that?
And the flame challenge is where scientists answer a question that 11-year-old kids have.
Uh-huh.
This year it's what is sound?
Oh,
so they got to answer it in a short video or a short written piece. But the 11-year-olds all over the world are the judges of the
explanation.
Who wins the best?
The scientist?
Yeah.
Oh, that's fun.
The kids judge the scientists.
What compelled you to do this foundation?
20 years ago, I started helping scientists make their work clear to the rest of us by interviewing them on television.
Right.
We did Scientific American Frontiers for 11 years. And it's a beautiful thing. It's really, it's exciting to hear what they're doing if you can understand it.
Right.
And I was relentless with them because I took my experience as an improviser and I just had a conversation with them. And I wouldn't give up if I didn't understand it. It wasn't about tossing them softballs and letting them give me answers that they already had.
Right.
They had to make me understand it.
Right. So you had to get to the nuances of things.
I had to get the vague idea first before we got to nuances.
Right.
And their expression changed when I did that. When I said, I don't get it. Tell me again.
Their expression changed to somebody who had to talk like a person?
Yeah. They had to relate to me suddenly.
Right,
they weren't
right.
talking out into the
right.
ineffable blue to
right.
some unknown audience. They were talking to me.
Right.
And they had to read my face and see if I was getting it.
Right, yeah.
So
yeah.
the vocabulary changed.
Yeah.
The tone of voice changed. And suddenly they got a greater sense of humor. They were really, we were together. We were in it together. So I realized when the show was over, what if nobody's standing next to these guys? Like me, pulling it out of them, making them relate. Is
right.
there any way to get them to relate to their audience so they have that same intimate approach that they had with me when I pulled it out of them?
Right.
I got it from improvising. So how about if we teach them improvising? So that's what we do. We've now taught 7,000 scientists improvising, plus we teach them how to distill their message so they get to the point and make you know why you should care about it.
Right.
But it all comes from paying attention to what you're thinking, not to what I want to tell you.
Right.
I mean, while we were talking about this just now,
yeah,
I saw your eyes open up and I saw you lean forward. I saw I had made a connection with you.
Yeah.
Up until then, I saw I hadn't because I was still trying to find the way to get to you.
Well, and also because, like, I think I know the answer, and I'll spit that out, and then it's not the right
exactly,
answer, and then you've got to, like...
And also, and I came at it mechanically. I started telling you when I started doing this, instead of getting to the good stuff, you know,
which is the
alive stuff.
Yeah.
Where we were together. I was talking about being together with the scientists.
Yeah.
There's such a difference between that connection and not having the connection.
Right.
And sometimes when they're starting to work with a scientist, say, because they're busy, they have a lot on their dish, you know,
sure.
and they say, well, why am I doing this exercise? How's this going to lead to improvise? How's this going to lead to communicating science? We stick with it, and we keep reminding them.
What kind of improvising do you do with them?
We used the, you know, Viola Spolin's work?
Nope.
She, about 75 years ago, she started creating this kind of improvising that's very pure. It's not comedy improvising.
Uh-huh.
And that the basis of it is to make a connection with the other person, just what I've been describing.
Yeah.
And your point of concentration is not on yourself, not on how am I doing, am I funny, am I smart,
right.
am I witty,
yeah.
but it's sharing the moment with the other person.
Yeah.
And when that happens, you lose these protective measures you take.
Uh-huh.
To protect yourself against being watched while you're on the stage. And you get into this community with the other person. And the two of you make things happen.
So this is what's at the core of your acting as well?
It is. To me, it's all about relating.
Now, like, where did you learn that?
From improvising.
Where did you start?
It's the only studying of acting I ever did,
so
except standing in the wings.
Right, but you were in college, and you wrote your musical. Did you study theatrical in college? Where'd you go? College here?
I went to Fordham.
Right up here?
In the Bronx.
Yeah.
And I went there partly because I thought they had a good theater department, but they canceled the theater department the year I went.
So what'd you end up studying?
I studied English, finally.
Yeah, that's what I did.
It's a good language.
It is a fine language, and there's a lot of good work done in it.
And the many good words in it.
Yeah. Yes, some of them were really exciting and interesting and explain things.
Wait, they're coming to get me. Can you hear that?
Yeah, I can. There's a lot of action down this street. It's not the greatest room sound-wise. It's a nice view, but not the best room for sleeping. So after college, where did you do? How did you start to pursue acting?
Well, when I was 16, in between college and high school, I got a job as an apprentice in a summer stock company. So that was the first time I was... In that theater, they actually paid you $25 a week to be an apprentice. Barnesville, Pennsylvania.
And it was like Shakespeare, or what they do?
Repertory? The movie stars would come through and plays.
Right, right. Who'd you see?
I was on the stage with Mae West.
Really?
Buster Keaton.
Really?
Isn't that amazing?
It is amazing.
And at the time, I didn't realize I was on stage with a genius. I just said, how does that guy do a backward flip and land in the seated position? And he must be 60 or 70 years old.
Oh, he was that old already.
I think so. Well, I was 16. He seemed older than he was, probably.
So he had no point of reference for him at the time.
No, and then I later realized what a genius he is.
And when you saw him do the, other than the back flip, was he pretty astounding?
Oh, he was wonderful. He was a real master.
Mm-hmm. He was an acrobat when he was a kid.
Yeah, and they used to throw him around the stage.
Right. I think he was one of those vaudeville kids that started out with a family of performers and was thrown around on the stage as
a
child.
So I used to watch from the wings every night during the show.
And Mae West, who was a kind of a comic genius.
She was, again, another brilliant woman. And every night there was Alexis Smith and Victor Jory, two movie actors.
Uh-huh.
Came through doing Noel Coward's Private Lives.
Right.
And I stood behind the scenery every night and just listened to the music of Noel Coward's dialogue.
Uh-huh.
It's so brilliant.
Yeah,
I mean,
yeah.
To hear something so well written as that and over again.
So witty.
It's witty.
Yeah.
And there was one exchange I'll never forget. It's a married couple who are on vacation with other spouses. They're divorced, but they're on vacation with other people. And they meet on vacation and fall in love and have an affair again, even though they're divorced. So they're having breakfast, and she says, aren't you a little worried we're living in sin? And he says, well, we're not, according to the Catholics, we're not living in sin. We've never been divorced. And she says, but darling, we're not Catholic. He says, I know, but it's good to know they're backing us up.
Yes, very clever.
That's a paraphrase, but I love that, the way it just bounces back and forth a ping pong ball.
Yeah, great comedy writing.
Yeah.
So you're doing that, you do the apprenticeship, and you're building sets and moving things around?
Yeah, and then I played parts. I played a long part in Charlie's Aunt.
Uh-huh.
And I always had a lot of chutzpah.
Right.
I had raw talent and nerve. And that's nerve is really important.
That'll carry you a long way.
Yeah, but I was afraid I'd lose my natural genius if I took lessons. I had a little too much nerve.
That's interesting, because that's something you obviously carried over from childhood, watching your dad. You had already made decisions about what authenticity was.
Yeah, right, right. So, I mean, this was all, I want to make clear that this was the wrong way to look at it.
You did all right.
Well, but what I thought was my natural genius turned out to be obnoxious mannerisms that took me 20 years to get rid of.
Yeah,
but I got rid of them by hook and by crook, mostly.
So what'd you do after that? Where'd you go?
I got a job understudying a leading part in a Broadway show that opened and closed on my Christmas vacation from college. So I didn't miss any school.
Yeah.
And then when I got out of college, I was already in love with my wife Arlene.
Yeah,
and we got married. She was a musician. She was playing clarinet in Houston, and I was in the Army for 6 months in Georgia. So we got married in Houston. I think we had $600 between us.
You enlisted?
No, I was in the ROTC.
Okay.
And then when we went to New York, and I spent the next 8 or 9 years trying to get some kind of work, and I was all kinds of things when I couldn't work as an actor, as a doorman and cab driver, sold mutual funds, mostly to myself.
Right. Just to show the boss you
were just couldn't resist the sales talk.
Yeah. I'm so good.
Yeah.
I'm really good at this. I bought another bunch.
So and little by little, I got more jobs and got a little better at what I was doing.
Yeah. Where'd you learn the improvising?
Along the way, around in there, I worked with Paul Sills, who ran Second City, and he had a workshop. And
here?
I did, yeah, in New York.
You never went to Chicago?
No, I did Second City a little bit here. I did Compass in Hyannisport.
Were they? Oh, they had a traveling troupe, the Compass?
It was just a summer show we did in a cabaret in the basement of the hotel where John Kennedy gave his press conferences.
And that was sort of improv-driven, wasn't it?
That was totally improv. With all the sketches in the first hour of the show were derived through improvisation, but they were set sketches. Then I would take suggestions from the audience, and we had, during the intermission, we'd say, okay, let's take this suggestion. Let's do it. You play that character. Wear this hat. I'll do this. We'd do total spot improvs for the whole second act.
Right.
And that was with no training. That was just guts improvising.
Well, that was what you were good at, you said.
Well, I had nerve.
Yeah.
Yeah. So we'd mush our way through these sketches, but the whole purpose was to get laughs and get to a blackout that deserved right. The lights going out.
And know? The guy in the lighting board has to be sensitive to when that is.
Yeah, or sometimes we just step off stage and throw the switch ourselves.
Oh, really?
Yeah. We've had enough of this.
And scene. The guy just left to shut the lights off. Yeah.
But then after that, I took those real serious classes based on theater games, and I really recommend that to young actors now.
With who?
I think it's
who'd you take with?
With Paul Sills, and okay. Sometimes with Viola Spolin. A couple mm-hmm. of times she came in,
but you somehow or another you managed to avoid the more method driven.
That's why I make up my own method every time I act.
Right? Were you off put by that?
I admired those actors. I thought Brando was brilliant. I over the years, I think I've seen some of the same kinds of mannerisms among those people from that school that they were replacing when their new kind of authenticity came in.
Well, everybody becomes a collection of ticks eventually.
Yeah, I think it's one of our jobs to try not to.
I think you're right. It's very interesting as some of those guys get older, you see that there is something they fall back on physically.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at movies for when that style of acting was most popular,
yeah,
and a woman, an actress, sees something that affects her, she puts her hand to her mouth,
yeah,
as if I'm about to cry.
Right.
I've almost never seen anybody do that in life.
That's true.
It's almost like what they were replacing, which was the Del Sarte method, where you hold your hands up to avoid some awful thing, you know,
right.
Put your hand on your head.
Yeah.
I can't take any more of this. You know? And these gestures that are supposed to convey something. I mean, it's really interesting. I mean, it's how you can act believably for your generation.
Yeah. Well, there's a couple of guys.
Strange question.
Those method movies, or at least the actors like Montgomery Clift and James Dean and certainly Brando, they all seem to be sort of constantly squirming.
Yeah, well, I think that came out of a decision to be aware of their own body, their own space, which was very successful in many ways. And I said a second ago, it just occurred to me to say, to be believable to your generation.
Yeah.
Your generation has just seen the past generations acting, and you have a new way of looking at things, and people will emerge who are convincing to you, but they may not be convincing to the next generation.
Right, or even to the generation before them.
Yeah.
Look at these kids.
Yeah, what are they doing? They don't know what they're doing. Can't even speak up.
Yeah.
You know, that kind of thing.
I can't understand that kid.
Sometimes I have trouble understanding the other actor because they don't talk as loud when they're acting as they do when they're ordering pizza.
It's weird, right?
Yeah, I don't get it.
I mean, sometimes some actors, I guess they know they're being mic'd, but on stage you would think they would project.
Well, there's a feeling that if you, on camera especially, if you do nothing, it's better than doing something.
Do you believe that?
Well, I don't think in life you ever do nothing. I think you're always trying to achieve something.
In every moment?
All the time. Yeah. I mean, even if you're catatonic, you're trying to avoid the pressure from the outside.
Right.
I mean, I'm probably now trying to impress you with my sense of art or something like that.
I like it, yeah.
But I'm also trying to find the right way to find the words to do it. We're always trying
active,
to do something.
Active,
you're, I mean, there's all kinds of things. When you're ordering coffee in Starbucks,
right?
Some part of you is just getting coffee. Some part of you is trying to find out something about the person behind the counter. Are you really paying attention to me? Did you hear what I said?
Things that. Right.
Things going on that are active.
Yeah.
And so if you just mumble, I'll have the latte.
Yeah.
Not wanting anything.
You're intentionally doing that to counteract something that
I think
is
in one way it sounds more real.
Right.
But in another way it sounds lifeless.
Right.
And that may be okay for some audiences because it's like radio. Your imagination puts the life in it sometimes.
Yeah, people bring their own stuff to every role.
You know that story about, I think it was Eisenstein, the great director in Russia, who made a movie where he showed a man in a window.
Yeah.
This is the first example of editing.
And montage, yeah.
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 Showed a man in the window looking at, and then he was looking down at the street, then the editor cut to what he's looking at, a baby in a baby carriage.
Right.
And he cut back to the guy looking. Cut back to violence happening in the street, a fist fight. Cut back to the guy. Cut back to a young couple kissing. Cut back to the guy.
Right.
Somebody watches the movie and is supposed to have said, what a brilliant actor.
Yeah.
How sensitively he reacted to each of those different scenes. And it was the same shot.
Yeah.
His expression never varied.
So the great trick of motion pictures.
Yeah, and that theory is probably behind doing nothing.
Because you know they'll save it in post.
Well, doing nothing can be interpreted in so many ways by the audience.
Right.
You know, just as like the guy in the window.
But not in a live theater situation. I mean, you know, this is just film acting.
You need a little more energy on stage anyway.
So you've been able to manage a very prolific show business career as an actor, being here on the East Coast. Yeah, I mean, when did you start doing the movies and bits of television?
Well, while I was still in my 20s.
Yeah? What were the first gigs?
All little nothing parts that little by little grew big. Actually, one of my first parts was a good part on the Bilko show with Phil Silvers, who had carried me on stage.
Did he remember that?
Yeah, he was very avuncular with me. He was very, very kind.
He was a real character, huh?
He was brilliant. I thought he was a really funny guy.
Yeah.
And a very sensitive guy, and when he would open in a show, he'd get laryngitis out of nerves.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Yeah. Do you have any experience of that? Do you get nervous?
I don't get nervous, but I lose my voice often.
You do?
Yeah. I think it's partly because in the Army, when I was 21, I got partly deaf in one ear.
It's still that way?
From the firing line.
Really?
And I never really heard my voice.
Yeah, yeah.
I couldn't hear my own resonance. So
right.
I think I
didn't. You yell?
No, I don't. I probably talk more softly than other people.
Ah. So, all right, so you did Bilko, and you did some other little parts.
Yeah, and then I got bigger and bigger parts on Broadway, and then I had my name over the title on Broadway, and then people knew me, and then I started making movies.
Yeah.
And then I was in the Utah State Prison when I got offered MASH.
What does that mean? What do you mean you're in the Utah State Prison?
I was making a movie in the Utah State Prison.
What movie?
It was called The... When was that? That was The Glass House.
Uh-huh.
And we made it with inmates playing parts of, you know, being background people. And
Who directed that?
A guy who's no longer with us, and I can't remember his name right now.
Yeah.
But he kept telling the inmates, you know, if you want to escape, you ought to make Alda a hostage. He says, they're not going to stop you if you have an actor. Do you believe this?
Yeah.
So two guys made me a hostage.
No, for real?
Well, they held a razor to my throat, so I don't know how real. Then later they said, we're getting out. You think we're kidding. We're getting out. And they later said they were kidding, but...
In the moment.
The razor was real.
So that director got you.
Yeah, we were right by the door to the outside. I think they were thinking, if this works, it's not a joke. If it doesn't work, it's a joke.
They could slip out with the production.
Yeah, and I don't think they got punished for that.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's a movie set, right?
So I went over to the director, and I just stared at him, and he said, I don't think the guard was in on it.
So you get masked. You're on the set?
Yeah. I first told my wife when I was in the prison, I said, this is a great script, but I can't do it because it has to be shot in California, and we live in New Jersey. So, I mean, I said, this thing could run for a whole year. Ran 11 years. You know? So she called me back the next day. She said, look, if it's that good, maybe we can accommodate it with travel.
Work it out.
Yeah. So I whenever I had 2 days off, I'd fly home.
Mm-hmm. Really? So is that much? Did they come out as well, your family?
During the summer, they came out, and we were done shooting in January. So for a few months out of the year, I would fly.
So after a year or 2 years, you didn't think, like, maybe we should get a place here?
No. We got a place, but but the kids were in school in New Jersey, and I didn't want to move them. They were just entering puberty, and it was their time to go to make their own world, not to be transplanted.
Well, that's generous. Good parenting.
Well, as it turned out, I went to the trouble of traveling, and they thought, hey, he's never here. What is this?
You can't win.
Because I'd get there Saturday morning,
right.
And be groggy, and I'd take a nap, and they'd say, okay, see you. We're going out now.
Right. So you weren't there, and you're doing the right thing for them.
Yeah,
and
but it worked out great.
It's
now a family tradition to travel to be together.
Oh, really? Yeah, yeah. They're all
it's
over.
Nice. Everybody sees it that way.
How many kids you got?
3 daughters and 8 grandchildren.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah,
you love it?
I love it. That's it's sweet. Great.
Yeah.
Anyone? What about you? Are you married?
No, I blew it twice. No kids.
Really? No, and nothing.
Huh? No, I'm special like that. I'm a special kind of asshole. You know, when you're 52 and you don't have children, somebody's right.
I'm sorry to hear that.
I'm okay with
it. But it's not too late. 52 is still young.
That's what I hear, but I'm starting to think, like, well, is that something I really need? Is something I need to do?
Well, if you don't think you need to do it, keep away from it.
Yeah, that's what I'm
thinking. You can destroy about 18 people.
That's right. Yeah. Repercussions for generations.
That's right. Yeah.
My brother's has 3 kids. He did what we needed to do.
Leave it up to him.
Yeah, let him do
it. Poor guy, slaving away, traveling, flying on planes.
Hard. Sounds hard.
The thing is, I had a friend once who said,
yeah,
because I said I had made the mistake of saying, you know, I don't think you really know who you are until you have kids to show you who you are.
I heard that too.
So he said, you know, I want to have children. He had never had children. Uh-huh. So I want to have the experience, he said. I said, wait a second. It's not an experience. It's a life sentence.
Yeah, right. It's a responsibility. But you enjoyed it.
Oh, God, yeah.
It worked out.
Yeah. I'm one of those people. I love babies. I love children.
Yeah.
And it gives me a lot of pleasure to pass them on the street and look at them.
Yeah. It's a beautiful thing. I don't know. I never had that thing in my head where I had to have them. I think maybe I'm too selfish or I'm
but
too
you
nervous.
Know that,
I'm
so
too
it's
anxious.
So good that you didn't.
Yeah.
Because then now you can spend your time doing what you want to do. And there are plenty of babies in the world.
There's no shortage of kids.
We have a young couple who are relatives of ours, cousins, who are perfectly capable of having babies, but they've adopted 2 because they want to help some of the babies that don't have anybody.
My brother adopted 3. Yeah, it's a beautiful
thing. Isn't
that
nice? That's great.
It is. It's really something. So you're schlepping back and forth. You're doing MASH, and it's a huge hit. You're working with Larry Gelbart.
Yeah.
And what was that relationship like?
He was great. He was such good company.
Yeah.
Such a wit. I often think about the wit he had, because when he said something, he had never heard it before, and he would smile at it too. But I thought, like all of us, he must have hundreds of lines going through his head. But he only says the one that's really good.
Yeah, and he comes from that amazing writer's room of the Show of Shows. And
all brilliant people.
Yeah, that must have been a big change for you. I mean, to go from New York show business to L.A. show business and see how that whole machine works and see how that all kind of transpires out there, right? I mean, you'd never done that type of television before, right?
No, although I hadn't. I hadn't done a show as far as I can remember. I had never done a show where every day you go into work,
right,
and you work long hours, and however the show turns out, you got another one to do the following week.
Mm-hmm.
That was an unusual experience because I'd come from years of not knowing what my next job would be, and now for 11 years, I knew exactly what the job was, and we all devoted ourselves to the job and to one another.
When did you know that it would be picked up year after year? Was there a deal made after a certain amount of time where you just knew it would be renewed?
At the end of the first year, we were successful enough that we knew we could keep going on
right
for a long time.
And when you say that you didn't know where Hawkeye came from, you know, in retrospect, where did it come from?
I was standing in the shed, in the aluminum shed on the compound.
Yeah.
Waiting for the first shot to take place.
Where was that shot? Out somewhere?
The exterior shots were in the mountains in Malibu.
Right.
Same place the movie was shot.
Yeah.
And I'm standing there in the shed by the door, and all I had to do is just a silent shot. You just have to walk across the compound. And I'm thinking, this is the first time I'm going to be Hawkeye. And I still, after 10 days of rehearsal, I still don't know who this guy is.
Yeah.
How am I going to do this? And I hear outside, quiet on the set. And I'm thinking, it's getting close.
Yeah.
And then they hear, scene one, take one. And the clapper slaps.
Yeah.
And the guy says, action. And I say, well, I got to go out that door now. And I open the door and I walk out on the compound and there's a nurse coming toward me. So I just reach out and grab her around the waist and pull her to me.
Yeah.
And she gives me a pat and she walks on. And I think, geez, that wasn't so hard. I'm Hawkeye.
God, that was it.
Yeah. I mean, I wasn't supposed to grab her. I just reached out for her.
That was that improv impulse.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I jumped into it. Some things you jump into. And some things you agonize over and sort of ooze into. And sometimes you agonize over and then jump into.
And when you saw these scripts, as these scripts came out, when you had that Gelbart sort of timing, you know, that and you were obviously the comedian of the whole enterprise there.
Yeah.
And you're playing off of Wayne and whoever. But, like, did you, like, someone mentioned to me that maybe, you know, Groucho had some influence on you.
No, you know,
have
just
you
as,
heard that?
Yeah, just as a gag, sometimes I would read some of the lines with a Groucho rendering.
Uh-huh.
And at one point, as a joke on a joke, Larry wrote a whole episode that sounded like it was narrated by Groucho.
Did anyone know
and
that?
And I did Groucho.
Oh.
And people said to Larry, how'd you get Groucho to narrate that episode?
No kidding.
Yeah, so I must have been okay with it. But I'm not a fan of the Marx Brothers movies.
Right, yeah.
For me, they're a little too silly.
Too slapstick, yeah.
Yeah, they don't quite make me laugh.
But what about Groucho's wit in general?
I loved him when he did the talks, quiz show.
Sure, sure. What was it called?
You Bet Your Life, was that it? Yeah. I thought that was really, he was really funny when he did that.
Now, in the Shift and Mash, because this is where, like, how did that all happen? You know, you'd done, what, 6 or 7 seasons before you started directing? And
no, I think I started at the end of the first season.
Oh, really?
I think so. I wrote the first script at the end of the first season. So, I don't know, maybe it was a second. I don't remember.
Was that exciting
and
for
I
you?
Direct, yeah, and I loved it. I learned a lot.
Yeah.
And the first show was a picnic scene. First show I directed was a picnic scene with about 80 people.
Uh-huh.
And I had several cameras, so I really leapt into it with both feet.
Yeah, and it's nice to have to be comfortable on a set and to know that you're supported by
a crew.
After
a while, several of us took turns directing.
Right.
And whoever was directing took it very seriously, and everybody else kept kidding around. So whoever was directing would say, all right, people, you know, and then everybody would say, get out of here.
Yeah, we know who you are. Yeah. Look at the big shot.
It was great fun. I wrote about 20 episodes of MASH, and I directed about 35.
Wow, that's a lot.
Yeah, and I really loved it.
And how did you find the writing experience? Because you were writing, you know, under Larry at one point, right?
Yeah, for 4 years.
And then he left the show eventually? Or
after 4 years.
And did you, what was the difference in when he was there to sort of show run and when you were able to do
it? Well, it all went, he was the last person to touch the script.
Right.
after he left, there were about eight people in a room, all pitching lines.
Writer's
and
room.
Sometimes it lost its focus because of that, I thought. And sometimes it got too filled with puns. I used to complain about puns.
I don't like puns.
Some puns are brilliant, I think. Some I would call classic puns. If they take something that's in the language, that's an idiom, and twists it with meaning,
right?
Then I think it's worth saying. And Larry could do that. And they'd say to me, well, Larry wrote puns. I say, yeah, but Larry wrote classic, great puns.
Right.
Just to say a word that sounds like another word,
that's not
funny.
No, it's got no depth to it.
Yeah.
So, but like when, because I had found, like just in my small experience with doing television, that if you're not careful, jokes will actually stifle the emotional flow.
Oh, no question about it.
That's what they're supposed to do. That's the subconscious intention.
That's interesting. I never thought of it that way. That's true. Tell me more about that.
Well, I think that it's just my analysis of myself is that, you know, when you're doing a joke, it's to deflect an emotional reaction from who you're talking to or yourself. You know, I mean, you can put a lot of punch and power in a joke. And
I thought it was just the experience of making you helpless with laughter that I was looking forward to.
Somehow that relieves it. That's the indication that you've gotten away with it.
Yeah.
That's what that means. Good. Now I don't have to deal with the real shit again.
But there is something about the helplessness of laughter that I really think is interesting.
Oh, no, it's a great relief.
If two people can laugh together, they're open to one another. They're vulnerable to one another.
Yeah.
Victor Borge, the great Danish comedian, said, laughter is the shortest distance between two people.
That's a beautiful way to put it. But I just know in writing, because I know that some people have said that when you had more writing power in MASH, that it was able to get a little deeper.
I don't know. Some people don't. There's like a myth on the internet that I made it more political and I made it serious, more serious. Larry was the first one to write a show in which a guy died on the operating table.
Yeah.
He went for serious, too.
Right.
In fact, the guy who ran the network, when he saw the show with the guy dying on the operating table, said, what is this, a situation tragedy?
Uh-huh.
So they already didn't like some of the seriousness because we realized we were doing, if we didn't show the bad effects of the war and just did a standard service comedy, we were in a way denying the real experience of the people who had lived through that
trivializing
time.
Trivializing it.
Yeah, absolutely. And there was more of interest if you took it more seriously. So we had silly, stupid, farcical, buffo stuff that we did, but it always had we tried to find an underpinning of the hard stuff.
Yeah.
But I don't like to write political messages, and I don't like plays that have political messages. So I don't think I'm responsible for that. I think it's just what people assume.
Yeah.
Because at the same time, I was trying to help get the Equal Rights Amendment passed. So everybody assumed that I put that stuff in my
So that
writing.
Was a spin? Was it a slag from the opposing?
It might have been partly that. I'm not sure.
Oh, yeah. Oh, well, it's nice that we can discredit it at the source.
Yeah, that's good. Take this opportunity.
And did you win some Emmys? You won a bunch, right?
Yeah. Well,
Over
the years, I've won 7 Emmys.
That's exciting.
But I lost 33.
And an Oscar? You lost an Oscar?
I lost an Oscar. I have a whole empty shelf at home.
That's where the Oscars go.
Yeah, this would have been my Oscar right here.
Well, you've certainly done some performances that obviously I think were Oscar worthy. I mean, I think that this is what's interesting to me, getting back to the Louis casting and the idea of you. Is that post MASH, you didn't not challenge yourself, and you didn't always play.
No, I wrote parts for myself that were people who were not admirable.
Right. In which movie?
The Four Seasons.
But that
I tell you, even the Four Seasons, he was a schmuck.
But that was Carol Burnett.
With Carol Burnett, yeah.
How good and is she?
Oh, she's wonderful. Wonderful to work. Everybody in that company was wonderful to work with. We had 3 weeks of rehearsal, and I said, all we have to do during these 3 weeks is get to be friends, because that'll show on camera.
Uh-huh.
And everybody immediately started telling personal stories about themselves.
Uh-huh.
It was so much fun to be together. And
that's a very funny bunch. You know, a lot of New York guys there. in that cast, huh? Tony Roberts.
Yeah, Tony Roberts and Jack Weston.
It's
interesting. I wrote a part for myself of a kind of annoying guy who's always controlling the conversation.
And a
critic interviewed me after he saw the movie.
Yeah.
And he said, tell me about your character. And I don't like to talk about characters that I play or that I write. I like to keep it sort of in my head.
Yeah.
And he ended by saying, "You don't really get it, do you? You don't know
what a
schmuck you are in this movie." And I thought, "What a schmuck you are! You don't think I know? I wrote it that way. I didn't contradict him though."
Oh, and Sandy Dennis was in it.
She was wonderful.
She's amazing. And okay,
when I took the movie to China,
yeah,
I showed it to Chinese audiences.
Yeah,
and somebody came up to me and said, "How did you get that woman with no acting experience in the movie?" They thought that Sandy Dennis was so believable that she was somebody off the street.
Really? Well, she kind of had that, huh?
Yeah, she was totally credible. Every moment was believable.
Is she a method person?
I think so, yes. I mean, that was an example of how well that can work.
Yeah. And also, like, in like Crimes and Misdemeanors, which is, I think is...
That's his best picture, I think. Movie. And one of the best pictures in America.
Ever. Like, I went through a period there where I couldn't shut up about it. I was like, you know, how is this not being heralded as one of the best movies ever made? It's a fucking
Well, some people say that, but not enough, in my opinion, because I think it's got everything. The serious story is a very unusual theme.
Yeah,
has
and,
a very
and it's everything that he was working towards, you know, that balance of comedy and tragedy.
The comedy is very human comedy. Yeah, it's not sketch comedy.
Right.
And it blends perfectly with the dramatic story. And it's a tantalizing story. To me, the basis of it is, if you do something really terrible, are you plagued by guilt the rest of your life? Or is it possible to just shrug it off?
Well, it's so funny with him because, you know, being, you know, just from reading his writing and sort of knowing that he read, like, the, you know, the Russian literature and, you know, and Dostoevsky and stuff,
right.
And that there's this, like, this horrible thing eating at you for life.
It's like an answer to that.
Yep, it is. It's pretty fascinating. And working with him, how, like, because I've only talked to a few people, but I get the sense that he hires people that he knows can do the job. He's sort of a little hands-off, huh?
I guess. Well, he does, in those days, anyway, he never spoke.
Right.
I made three movies with him. You and I have now spoken more than we spoke in those three movies.
What do you think that is? Do you think it's
I think he's just uncomfortable talking to people, and he doesn't like to see things over and over again. So he's made these two things the hallmark of his directing style. If you shoot close-ups,
yeah,
you have to shoot the same movie three or four or five times.
Right.
So he does everything in master shots.
Right.
Almost entirely.
Uh-huh.
So he only has to see it once. He doesn't, you know, you don't have to break it down.
Right.
Go back and do the shot again.
Interesting.
If he wants in a close-up, when I was working with him, if he wanted a close-up, he'd call you in, you'd say one line and go home.
Right.
You know, usually you play the whole scene. But then he doesn't like to talk to people, so he doesn't give you, maybe he gives more direction now. It might have changed. I haven't worked with him in a few years.
You did a couple of pretty big movies. The Joe Tynan movie was a big movie. I remember seeing that when I was a kid.
Yeah, I wrote that. You know.
And that was a political character.
Yeah, I wasn't trying to make a political point.
I get that.
It was a personal story.
It was a moral story.
Yeah, well, it was about can you keep your head when you get big?
Right.
And you stay focused on things that matter to you.
Was that something you were struggling with?
I don't think so. I think it was something I was
curious about,
curious about.
Flesh it out?
Yeah.
Through fiction?
Yeah. I don't think, I don't know, maybe unconsciously came a little bit from the fact that I had teenage daughters and I was away working a lot and trying not to be drawn too far away from them.
Yeah.
But I don't think I did that consciously.
Oh, yeah?
You know, all of the stuff that we do, writing and acting and I think probably even comedy too, although I've never done stand-up, but I get the impression that in all of these endeavors, we're trying to find some relationship with our unconscious that's workable, that's usable. Because in the unconscious, that's where all the work is going on.
Yeah.
You know, brain scientists have told me there's what they call the default mode.
Yeah.
Where you don't think you're doing anything. You don't think you're focused on anything. Time is just drifting by.
Right.
You might be driving a car or you might just be sitting staring out the window.
Yeah.
If you were in an MRI machine, a functional MRI machine, where they can watch what's happening in your brain right now,
yeah,
they'd see all kinds of activity during that default mode when you think nothing is happening.
Yeah.
That's when the machine in the background is churning out answers to questions and problems and sorting things out, figuring out what's the best course to take.
Yeah.
And I think that when we sit down to write or we get ready to do a performance, we're getting in touch with that stuff in the background, letting the stuff come out, which is why I think improvisation was so important to me, because it put me on a path to that. You not only get connected with the other person, you get connected to your own inspiration.
Oh, yeah, it's amazing. That, I mean, I do all my comedy writing through talking it through on stage and waiting,
It comes to you.
Well, yeah, sometimes things are okay. They're funny enough. And then all of a sudden, out of nowhere, and I'm so thrilled by that moment where you say something new and it becomes the punchline of the thing.
And then it becomes your act.
That's right. But it comes out of the air. And, you know, you know, if people go, you wrote that, I'm like, it was delivered.
Yeah,
it was
delivered. You're like the lightning rod.
I don't know where it came from. And some of them, like, I have no idea where they came from. Obviously, they came from my mind in that moment.
See, that must be similar to what famous scientist said. I can't remember his name right now. He said, inspiration comes to the prepared mind.
Yeah.
Everything you did before that was setting things up probably in the back of your head, and then it comes from apparently out of the blue.
Right. Well, that's like acting. It's like what you were saying. It's about improvising. Once you find a certain comfort zone in the territory of the stage or whatever you're in, once you're no longer afraid, and that's where you live,
yeah,
then that's the work.
Right.
Like if you go up there and say, like, I'm not afraid of this, and I have an audience, something's going to happen.
Right.
You know,
right.
Even if it's not great, it'll be compelling.
Yeah, and it all to me comes from the fact that the whole process is associative.
Yeah.
I mean, we remember things by associating them with other things.
Yeah.
And I think we create things in the same way. Some new idea comes to us because it's got a hook on it that's attached to the hook of something else that might even seem unrelated, but
it's great
in the back of the head, the one pulls the other out.
Yeah, that's a creative process.
Yeah.
Right?
That's why you just got to, when you're writing, you got to put anything down, because that'll make other stuff come out.
Yeah. Well, the interesting thing that Louis said about Horace and Pete is he had this idea, and he says when he has ideas, he doesn't know whether or not they'll write.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, so you put him down, it's like, is it going to write?
And he told me he wrote it like a written improvisation.
Yeah.
It wasn't, now here's my outline, now I'm going to write this scene, now I'm going to write that
scene. That's how he does everything. He puts it down, not a lot of going back.
See, he's got a really fertile mind. He's a brilliant guy. I just loved watching him. I loved watching him act, write, direct.
Yeah. It's interesting when you know somebody a long time, and if they get to a certain place in life where, like before Horace and Pete started, you know, when he was about to do it, he told me the whole thing. Like, he was at my house. He did a little voiceover thing for my show. And he was so excited about it, but it was so secret, he couldn't talk to anybody. And we talked for 2 hours. He's like, you didn't record this, did you? You can't tell anybody about this. No one knows about this.
And he was so funny when he begged us not to tell anybody.
It worked.
I didn't tell my children, my grandchildren.
He scared you.
And tell anybody.
But then it was funny, though, because a week later, he was like, God, we should have recorded that.
How long have you been doing interviews?
Since 2009.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, yeah. I've talked to a lot of people. So do you like playing, like in the West Wing, you play like a Republican.
Yeah.
Gunning for the presidency. Do you like doing that?
I'm just trying to play people, you know?
And
if I can play people, you know, a wide range of people, that makes it more interesting. Instead of playing the same person. I haven't consciously played the same person ever, although some people might think so.
No, you're actually one of those people that I don't think does that. It's only because the expectation is drilled into their head from Hawkeye.
Yeah, partly that. And partly I may have undermined myself by going on television and in interviews as myself.
Right.
So people have some impression of me from that.
Well, here's what I learned or what I got from watching you. And in The Aviator too, you know, that guy's a heavy guy.
He's a bad guy.
Yeah. And that's a, you know, and it seems to me like what you were saying before about finding these people within you is that, you know, you can make a few different decisions within your own sort of personality that completely change the emotional direction of who that character is. Like, you know, I still see Alan Alda, but I don't think of you as Alan Alda in any of those parts because of a tweak you do within yourself. Because you're not doing dialects. You're not.
Yeah, and I wear a putty nose and things.
That's right.
Like, I wear wigs.
You know what I mean,
like
though.
That.
But there's
a
skill.
Really,
of it.
I really try to see how different I can be without exterior changes. Oh, once in a while, I mess my hair up or something. Like, I wear a beard, you know, but not too much.
But there are certain
it's,
actors.
It's like a challenge to myself.
Right, you know? Right. It's just there's a minor like Nicholson does that too, where it's like, you know, it's Jack Nicholson, but he just removes or adds something.
Yeah.
You know, to the emotional dynamic.
All I try to do is all comes from improvising. I try to discover something. It's what you described before about the line coming to you
right.
from out of the blue.
Right.
I just keep doing it until something in me is behaving like this person
feels
seems
right.
to be.
What, feels right.
It's how the person would be. But I don't decide to do it. I don't put it on uh-huh. if I possibly can.
Did you like saying fuck so much?
Yeah, well, I
it's
say
exciting,
that in
right?
real life a
yeah,
lot.
Yeah,
yeah.
yeah. It's a good word, right?
Yeah.
So in terms of like, you know, do you enjoy comedy better or do you just don't, you just do whatever it's going to come?
Well, I love making people laugh. You know, to help raise money for this, the Alda Center for Communicating Science,
right.
I go out and talk for an enormous fee, and the whole fee goes to the center.
Right.
But it's like a one-man show, and I have, and there are as many laughs in it as I can find, although I talk about something that's meaningful.
Yeah.
I try to.
Yeah.
But I love to make people laugh, but it's what we started talking about before.
I'm
also interested in meaning.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that's why I never really got off on the Three Stooges.
Yeah, I'm not a slapstick guy either. It needs to hit me a little
and
deeper.
And I recognize there's a tremendous amount of skill in slapstick.
Oh, yeah, definitely. When someone's a good physical comedian, it's astounding.
I mean, like, I love Buster Keaton.
Yeah.
And I love so much of Chaplin.
There's some guys that can do it really well. When Ben Stiller puts his mind to it, he can really do physical
comedy.
Yeah,
he's a very, very, he's a wonderful actor. He's got a lot of sides to him.
I have a tremendous envy for people who are naturally physically funny. Like, you know, there's certain guys that can just stand there and be funny without doing nothing.
Yeah.
And it's like it's a gift.
It really is.
Yeah, like Gleason.
Yeah,
you know, even
and what he was like a genius.
Yeah, he's just
he could just do flat out sketch comedy, and then act a part in a movie.
Yeah,
where he was a heavy and totally believable.
Right, it's rare.
Moment to moment believable,
mm-hmm.
and there was no sense. You know, Milton Berle was a funny guy.
Right,
but when he played a serious part. He put a mute on himself.
Right.
And you could see him muting his comedic
his
instinct.
His impulse. Yeah.
And he wasn't the person he was trying to play. He was Milton Berle with a mute on.
Exactly. Yeah.
And Gleason didn't have that. Gleason could be the person.
What do you, what do you want to direct more movies and write
no,
more
No, I don't
movies?
Want to direct anymore. I didn't have a good time the last time I directed.
Which was that?
Betsy's Wedding.
No good?
I didn't enjoy it.
Yeah, what happened?
Yeah. Never mind.
Okay.
I should use that what a young director used when he was asked about an actor he didn't like working with. They said, "Was he hard to work with?" He said, "I don't remember."
But what about writing?
Well, I write books now, and I write. I wrote a couple of plays about science. I wrote a reading for the stage about Einstein, and I wrote a play about Marie Curie. And I'm working on a book now.
Oh yeah, about your life or a fiction?
No, it's about what I think I've learned communicating science, but how it applies to everybody.
Yeah, this is like your mission right now.
Yeah, I mean I love acting and writing, and I still do that.
Yeah,
you know, when I felt so lucky to meet with Louis.
Yeah.
And do Horace and Pete.
Yeah,
because that's like my ideal thing.
Yeah.
To have this chance to come in and do something hard and work with brilliant people.
It was great.
What with for an audience that gets it, that's what I've wanted all my life from the time I was a kid.
Yeah.
So I have that, and I have this other thing where I really can be helpful to scientists, and they're flocking to us to for us to help them. So
and also getting kids interested.
Yeah, yeah. The other day I was online with kids from 7 schools,
uh-huh.
and they were discussing the finalists in this flame challenge contest.
Yeah, 11-year-olds.
11-year-olds, yeah, yeah. And they were talking with the intelligence of some of the people on some boards I've been on.
Well, boards are not known for their intelligence.
That's why they're bored.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, well, I said a pun.
Yeah, you did.
So,
I blew right by me.
I know, thank God. I know, you didn't flinch or anything.
I didn't.
So these kids were so smart, and they were actually, they were talking about whether or not the writer of the entry knew his audience or didn't know it. They were already thinking about how to communicate science, and they're 11.
That's great. It's a great thing.
Yeah.
That's something I missed out on. You know, I take a lot of things for granted, and my curiosity doesn't tend that way.
But you're curious. You wouldn't be a good listener if you weren't curious.
I'm very curious about human things. Human, you know.
So there's a lot of science that's about human things.
Yeah, I know, but I don't want it to ruin the poetry. But then
it doesn't. It's more poetic.
I know. That's what people say.
It's look. You look at a daffodil.
Yeah.
It's pretty.
Yeah.
It's yellow.
Right.
There's a lot of stuff else about it. There's stuff crawling all over it.
Yeah, I know. I mean, I did a little. I can get into that rabbit hole and learn those things, and it makes me happy. I think I'm worried about the brain stuff more.
Yeah, well, there's a whole world of that's like a new frontier.
Yeah, I don't know if it goes anywhere good, does it?
Oh, sure.
Okay.
The more you know, the better, right? Are there things you don't want to know?
No.
If you don't mind knowing you're going to die, then there's nothing that should hold you back.
No, you're right. You're right. Maybe it's just a matter of discipline in terms of managing my curiosity properly.
Yeah. Well, you also the way things are communicated now, you have to go to a little trouble to learn the lingo.
Yeah.
And I'm trying to help fix that. There's
break,
a
break, crack the code.
Yeah. There's a movement.
Yeah.
That I'm part of that I'm very happy to see growing. So that scientists won't speak in code
right.
that only they understand. And not all of them understand one another's code, so it's not helpful to them.
Right, right.
So if we can keep in mind what's happening in the mind of the person we're talking to, then we'll all share it. It belongs to all of us.
Yeah, I think that's beautiful.
I mean, you should be able to enjoy it.
A daffodil all the way through.
And your brain.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think maybe I'm being willfully ignorant just out of laziness.
Well, somebody will excite something in you.
Oh, no, I can get excited about stuff. Yeah, in science. I'm going to try.
No, don't try. It'll come over you the same way the joke does when you're out there on stage.
All right. Well, thanks for talking to me, Mr. Alden.
Alan, come on. After all this time.
I know.
I mean, we've been in that bed already.
I know. It was unmade, and you still laid in it. Thank you, though.
Thank you very much.
Beautiful man, beautiful conversation. It was a real honor to talk to him, even though he gave me his cold. I forgave him. I wrote it out. He gave me his cold. I gave it to Sarah. We're all connected. After Alan left, I actually carried his cold with me for another few weeks. Go get my More Later special if you'd like. It's there at WTFpod.com until September 1st for $7.99. After that, it's going to be up on iTunes for a little more. There's a link on the homepage as well as the merch section. Great. Great. Tired. Made the drive. I think I'll play a little laid-back guitar. Maybe. Hold on. Hey folks, this episode is brought to you by Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues, your ally to help tackle your allergy symptoms this season. I love the change of seasons, but nobody loves pollen and all those other things floating in the air that make you sneeze during this nice weather. Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues are hypoallergenic and allergist approved. So fight back against watery eyes and runny noses without worrying about irritating your skin. You know all those times you've heard guests sneeze on the show? Well, actually, you don't hear any of that because we cut the sneezes out when we're editing. But take my word for it, people definitely sneeze in here, and when they do, I've got a box of Kleenex on the table right in front of them so they can use one and get right back to business. And here's what Kleenex means to me: a tissue that will hold up. We've all used those other tissues that you blow holes right through. When I see Kleenex, I know that tissue is up for the job. For this allergy season, grab Kleenex and face allergies head on.